Sweet Spot listeners, we have an incredible deal on a new product from one of our favorite companies, ShotScope. You know that if you listen to this show, Adam and I are big on strategy and tracking stats like strokes gained. ShotScope has just released their new V5 GPS watch. There are tons of upgrades like full color maps of each hole, GPS distances to hazards, layup points, and doglegs, and more importantly, dynamic yardages to the front, middle, and back of every green. You're also going to get 16 of their second generation shot tracking tags that will automatically track all of your shots. That way, you're going to get access to over 100 statistics on their online portal, and you'll be able to see your strokes gained and handicap benchmarking against other golfers. So if you want to make a plan to improve, you can clearly see which part of your game needs the most help, and more importantly, the whys. The best part about ShotScope is that there are no ongoing fees for using their stat tracking portal. So now for our deal. We are giving Sweet Spot listeners in the US and Canada a $70 discount. Yes, you heard that correctly. That brings the price of the watch down to $179.99. All you have to do is go to ShotScope.com, add the V5 GPS watch to your cart, and use promo code SWEETSPOT, that's one word, at checkout. Once again, go to ShotScope.com, add the V5 GPS watch to your cart, and use promo code SWEETSPOT for your $70 discount. Welcome back to another episode of The Sweet Spot. This is John Sherman from Practical Golf.
Adam from Adamian Golf.
So we are super excited to debut this episode with Mike and Eli from Chasing Scratch. We know we have a lot of fans of their show who listen to The Sweet Spot. I just wanted to make a quick note. This episode was recorded in February of 2022. We wanted to hold on to it because we knew that their season 5 would be debuting sometime in May. So just so you know that this is a few months in the past for those who are following Eli and Mike on their journey. And without further ado, here's our conversation. So today is the day. We have some very special guests here. We've got the Chasing Scratch Boys, Mike and Eli. What's up?
What's going on, guys?
Thanks for having us.
I feel a lot of pressure. This is a hotly anticipated episode. Twitter was Twitter is really buzzing on this one. So hopefully we'll do it justice. And you know, we've wanted to have you guys on for a long time because if there was a Venn diagram of like podcasts. Like if you go on Apple Podcasts and you go to our show, The Sweet Spot, and click related, you're number one. Like you're the most related podcast. And then if you click on your show and click related, we're number one. So I feel like the Venn diagram of Chasing Scratch and Sweet Spot is like two circles completely overlapping. So I know we have a lot of people excited for this one.
Gosh, I hear Venn diagrams, pivot tables. I don't know about you all. It just gets me excited. Just ready to go.
And then you shade in the middle with Carl Weathers. And then yeah, everyone's all together.
Oh, boy. So for the people who perhaps there are some Sweet Spot listeners who have not engaged with Chasing Scratch yet, can you introduce yourselves, tell us a little bit about the journey and how you guys got started?
Sure. My name's Mike, and my co-host is Eli over there. And we've been friends since college. About 4 years ago, or is it 5 years ago, Eli?
I think it's five.
Well, it'll be five.
Yeah,
it'll be five. So about 4.5 years ago, we were both 11 handicaps. All of our time together was always based on playing golf. We took you know, numerous golf trips a year, and we just got tired of sucking on those golf trips. And we just decided, we said, hey, what if we retire from every non-work activity, any other recreational activity, and just try to get better at golf? How good could we get? And we said, let's record and maybe we'll make a podcast, and we'll say, can we get down to scratch in a year? And that answer was no, because obviously we're about to go to season five.
But that's why we're on season five.
But that's basically it. And so we have gotten better, but we have not achieved the ultimate goal. Eli, did I leave anything out?
Well, I was going to say we got down as the lowest we've gotten are threes, and we both hit, I think, 3.5. We both hit 3.5. Mike, isn't that right? I mean, which, by the way, you forgot to mention, we live in different states. So the fact that we ended up at 3.5 is purely coincidental, but that is the low point for both of us. And it was nice to be there. We waved at it. We saw it flash by the window for a few minutes. And then I think we sit now, five or six, right around there.
The funny part is we keep ending the season on exactly the same handicap. So we ended that 1 year at 3.5. I think we're both 5.6s right now.
That's pretty significant progress, though. That's impressive.
I think we took out a lot of the season one was kind of taking out low hanging fruit, you know, and also just playing a lot more. I think, you know, you clean up a lot of mistakes just being out there and playing more. But I think, you know, once we hit that 6-7 range, you know, I think we started to introduce more instruction. But once we hit threes, it was like, okay, you have to really get intentional with what you're doing now, or this next part is not going anywhere. And that's kind of been the hard part for us.
But I do want to say that the second season, when we talked to Adam, that's when we got our lowest. And I want to tribute all that to the founder of our religion,
the guru, Adam. That's the reason we're Rajneeshis now, is because of
Adam. I get so many emails from you guys. I've done a lot of podcasts in the past, but I've never had so many emails from one podcast. You've got an amazing group of followers. I wish my followers liked me as much. Your followers like me more.
It is. I mean, on a serious note, I mean, you guys, when I first saw it, when I first came across the show, you know, a few years ago, and I was like, okay, another group of guys going for scratch. And I'm like, here we go. And it just has, like, I've just been blown away. Like, you go on Twitter, I mean, I've turned on PGA Tour broadcasts and people are screaming, come on, Rick. And I'm just like blown away by what's occurred, because you have this like community around it, and it's kind of like gone way beyond your quest for scratch. Like, there's a legitimate community. You had people travel from all over the place for your finale. I watched it on YouTube recently. You got Irish Mike there, Mike Carroll from Fit for Golf, who's been a guest on our show. And it's just, it's really cool to see, just because, like, I don't want to get too off the road here, but, like, you know, people criticize golf. Golf outsiders like to talk down on us, like we're these snooty group of people who exclude. And what I see amongst your community is like total inclusion. Like, people are encouraging each other. I've seen tweets about, you know, guys who are saying, like, listen, I was struggling with my mental health, and this community around the show has really helped me in reaching out to people and getting games with them locally. So I've just been like blown away by what's happened, and I'm super impressed. So kudos to you guys.
I think that's probably been the coolest takeaway above anything. You know, we've had, and it is very humbling, but we've had just a ton of people that say they just feel better after listening to our show. And I don't know if that's because we are the model for what not to do. So people, you stack against the benchmark and you're constantly outperforming, you know, but it's really cool for people, you know, people to get on and say, you know, we always leave with a smile on our face, which I know Mike and I get a real good kick out of.
Yeah, that's one thing we didn't think anyone would listen to the show, you know, period. So, you know, what's happened with our group of listeners. It's amazing. We love those people.
Sweet. Well, we're going to maybe dive into your games a bit. Maybe we'll give you some help here. We'll ask what happened, because I think the two of you are kind of, you know, as I've listened to the show in the past, you're like the poster children of what not to do and now what to do. Like, there is an element of, you know, people are getting educated by your journey, you know, going from having seven different swing thoughts on a chip shot. And just, I mean, I think that's why people enjoy the show so much, is because everyone can relate to what this game does to us. It can drive us totally insane. You can go through periods of huge breakthroughs, like you guys talk about getting down to a 3 handicap. That's exceptionally good. And then you're going backwards a little bit. You plateau, you go backwards. So no matter what level of golfer you are, there's always that shared relativity of the game where we know what that feels like. And I'm sure you guys are seeing, and we were having some banter about our scratch golf episode earlier. We were trying to be kind to you guys, but that final step of going from like that 3-2-1 handicap to 0, if that is your eventual goal, like, those are often the hardest steps to make. It's just like, you're right there, you can taste it, and there's just some other things you have to clear up, and maybe we'll talk about what you guys think are the last steps to get there.
Yeah, we're ready. I've got my feet up on the couch. I'm ready to get a psychological evaluation and any help you can get.
You guys represent what we want to be. So yeah, we thought we'd just show up and you guys would just make us better.
So where are you with your games now? I know you talked about your handicap, but what's the plan, I suppose, for the winter and for the next summer coming up? How are you going to shave those last three shots off? Or five now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for that reminder.
So actually, Irish Mike, he turned us on to the Golf Metrics app last year, which we had never really dove into our strokes gained and analyzing it like that, which I think that was some light bulbs for us. So I can, very specifically for me, I can tell you that the driver is just, I've got to get really good. I've got to do a John Sherman where I turn a weakness, where I turn something I'm scared of into something that I'm very confident in. And that's the biggest thing for me. There's some other areas where I need to clean up around, 20 to 60 yards and some things like that. But my average driver handicap was an 11 last year. And those rounds, I had a few rounds that were plus ones. And then I had one round that was a 40. I had a couple rounds in the 20s and 30s.
Oh my God, 40?
Like Eli can tell you, like, it's either there or it's not there.
If I'm recalling correctly from the season finale on YouTube, Eli, you were hitting some tremendously long. You had a few drives over 300, if I'm remembering correctly. And then at the end, I think the two of you was on like the 17th or 18th hole. I'm like, it was a par four. I'm like, and then the thing saying you have 230 in or something. I'm like, what the hell happened here? Like, is it Mike? Like, what's going on with your driver? Is it penalty? Like, when you've established that you're losing strokes relative to, are you saying the benchmark is a scratch golfer in Golf Metrics?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So you're losing how many strokes on average to a scratch golfer off the tee?
Oh, I know the handicap number. I don't have that.
So you were like an 11 handicap.
11
like
handicap.
Have you gone deeper in that? Is it a distance issue? Is it a penalty stroke issue? Penalty strokes. Okay.
And when it's a direction issue, I'd also look at, is that a strategy thing? For example, if you hit it 30 yards offline and it's out of bounds, and then you look and you say, well, the other side of the fairway is clear, or even the other rough is clear, that's not necessarily a direction issue or a technical fault in such. Or, I mean, it is a technical fault, but by biasing your aim more towards the right side of the fairway or away from danger, that could alleviate it as well. So, the strokes gain stuff is really good. I keep it myself, but I also keep track of when I'm losing shots, why? And something you can do with the strokes gained app, with the Golf Metrics app, is go through each shot and go through each drive and look for the negative values and then actually attribute that to something. Say, okay, well, that was -1 because it was out of bounds. Well, I probably could have played a little safer strategy there and aimed at the right side of the fairway instead of the middle. Or, if it was just a pure technical fault, say, was it a toe hook? To which you'd write down, okay, I need to work on my face strike, or was it just a good strike that went left, to which it's going to be face direction? So you start to understand then, well, I'm losing strokes, but why? You're going deeper as to why, because that helps you with your training, right?
I think on the aiming, I would just jump in here. I think the aiming piece is really interesting, because we did an episode last season. I think we called it Safety First, but we kind of had this epiphany it sounds so ridiculous, but our aiming was horrible. And, we kind of would say, and it started with me mostly, Mike would go, I'd get up to a box and I'd get ready to hit and he'd go, where are you aiming? And I'd go, oh, I'm on the left half of the fairway. And he'd go,
I'd throw my club at the ball. Yes. So he wouldn't
literally,
so he wouldn't swing
he would throw something at it and he'd go, you're aimed in the middle of the woods. And I would go, no, I'm not. And he'd go, yeah, you really are. And so I'd come back And then I'd realign. I'd go, okay, where are you at? And he's like, slightly better, but still in the woods. And so, you know, we had this session where we played an entire round. It was eye-opening, but we played an entire round and we said, you have to call, you have to tell the other person exactly where you're aiming and the shot you're going to play. You have to verbalize it. And so we got to the second hole and it like Mike had the tee box. It was a par three. You remember this, Mike?
Oh yeah.
It was a par three, huge green. The green was a mile wide. And I said, okay, what's the shot? And he said, I'm going to aim just barely right of the flag. I'm going to play a little draw just right to the center. And he lined over the ball. And I said, okay, you're aimed into the middle of the trap to the right of the green. And he stepped back. He realigned. He was aimed to the left half of the trap now on the right of the green. So we killed him. I mean, he was like, what are you doing? You don't know how to aim. Then I got up and did the exact same thing. And, you know, it was just kind of this eye-opening piece where we were like, gosh, we're killing ourselves before we even pull the club back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's a physical. Sorry.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that come to mind on that. Another question I would have is, are you stepping onto the golf course with a plan on targets off the tee? Like, do you know beforehand when you step on the course, whether it's one you've never played before or, you know, your normal course, do you know what club you're taking off the tee and your target even before you tee it up? Or is it just kind of like this haphazard, well, we're going to see how it goes and change my decisions based on that? Like, how's that looking for you, Mike, when you're on the course?
I'd say I've made some improvements there. Earlier in the year, I would have said, I don't have a plan. But then mid last year, I talked to someone. We actually, it's a listener of ours who's a swing coach, but he walked me through the course. We did the Google Earth thing. We planned out every single shot on my home course that I should play based on my shot shape, where to aim, all that kind of stuff. So I did walk in with a strategy. And then to Eli's point, I think we did learn how to aim, you know, mid last year. So I think that was an issue earlier last year, but I don't think it was an issue late last year. But none of those things, I mean, there was still just a stark difference between when the driver was right and when it was wrong. And when it was wrong, I just have a hard time getting it back. I believe it's a face control issue. And the days I don't have it, I don't think it's an aiming, because the misses are so far wide.
Mm.
And Eli, you can vouch for me on this. Like, the misses are so far wide both directions.
Yeah, I was gonna say, that's a problem. It's a two-way miss.
So it's something I need to figure out for sure.
I think the other thing on the aiming front that was just, again, you don't know what you don't know, but I remember I went in for a lesson. I think it was early last year. Mike, you may have been with me, but I went to see the local pro here that I meet with, Larry Ward, and I was having an issue. I was just going through a period where I was just having these hard pulls off, you know, with the driver. And I said, I can't figure it out. I don't know what's going on. And I'm going in thinking we're going to change my swing plane and we're going to do all this crazy stuff. And he took me out, you know, he took me out to the hitting area and there was a flag in the distance. And he said, aim at the flag. And, you know, I go and I snap, you know, I pull one hard again. And he said, you know, you're aimed a mile right of the target. And he said, your body intuitively knows it is aimed so far right. And it's adjusting for the way you're positioning it, which was, so, you know, he lined me up and aimed me correctly. We didn't change a single thing with my swing. And all of a sudden these nice little pretty fades. I mean, immediately it was like fade, just baby fade. And I think that was a real eye opener for me, how athletic your body is. And how it can know where you're setting it up for failure immediately and just try to overcompensate. And I think there was probably a little bit of that, Mike, with you early on. But like you said, I think you've cleaned a lot of that up. Now it's just, you just have horrible, horrible mechanics. And I don't know how you're going to tackle those.
How did you guys clear up you said you've managed to clear up the alignment issues by the end of the season? Is there a drill that you went through with that, or is it just purely practicing with alignment sticks down all the time?
We actually made a rule that both of us kind of signed a pledge.
It's a blood oath.
Yeah, we wore a pledge pin that you could not take a range shot without an alignment stick down. So we did that we stuck to that. And then the other thing I think is just learning a little bit of routine that actually Larry gave you, Eli, when I was there. But the lineup and then a quick head look, moving your head to kind of see, and once you're kind of used to where your eye should be looking when your head kind of moves. I don't know if I'm doing a great job explaining that because we're not on video, but I think we got both practice and a routine down to where we felt comfortable we were aiming the right place.
Do you guys use an intermediate marker as well? Something in front of the ball, you know, a couple of feet. That's something that, you know, almost every professional uses. And is that something you added, or is that something that was always there that didn't help you?
It's something that I added. And I, just to be honest with you, I think I was just lazy and I didn't want to do that. And so I have to make myself take, I try to play as fast as possible. I think that's, and that was one thing I didn't want to add into the routine until I saw how valuable it was, because yeah, that intermediate, that 2 feet in front of the ball, like that just made a huge difference for me when, cause it doesn't look like you're aimed. Yeah. That made a big difference for me.
I think the feeling of being properly aligned initially, and it took a little bit to get through this, but it felt like I was aimed 90 yards left of target. And it was just, it really took a while to, like Mike said, it was a bunch of alignment sticks and just really being more intentional about range practice. I think that was the other eye-opening thing too. It was like, we would go out to the range and we've talked about this on the show plenty of times, but you know, we go out to the range and if I hit three good drivers, I was like, put that one in the bag. We're good. I'm ready to play that thing. And you know, it was like, I didn't pay attention to where I was aimed or, and I think the other thing too, with the specific target, you eliminate any just ambiguous analyzation of your shots. You know, it's like, that was pretty good. I think that would have probably been pretty straight, you know, on the course. It's like, no, that was a target. And, you know, Adam, I use your game that you gave us with the fingers. You know, it's like 3-finger, 2-finger, you know, 1-finger. But there's just no guesswork then. It's like, that's not an acceptable shot, or that is an acceptable shot. And I think it just makes your practice so much more deliberate and intentional. Yeah.
One of the best drills that I found for alignment, because it's based on that feel, is to go through your usual routine, line up to the target, then look at the target to make sure the feel is there, the perception, and say to yourself, does this feel like I'm lined up correctly? And then rather than hit the shot, actually place the club on the ground on your feet and step back out of the shot and then check. And often you'll be surprised, because otherwise you need someone else to tell you, right? But if you go through this, you can say, well, this feels perfect to me. And then you put the club down, you stand back, and you're like, oh, wow, I'm aimed 60 yards right here. And then you just repeat the process and adjust it. And that might mean feeling as if you're aiming, as you said, way right or way left. Feel is not real. But that changes over time the more you practice that drill.
Yeah, I've definitely done that myself, because I can get super closed without realizing it. And I don't use video. I don't really use alignment sticks, to be honest with you, that much. But what Adam says, like I was doing that in Florida recently. I was hitting some balls in the middle of the winter. It's like, I'm just hitting shots. I have my target. I'm reacting. I'm seeing where it ends up. But at the same time, like, I just like to check in on my feet alignment. I think we should do a whole episode on alignment. I think feet alignment is a very personal thing. I don't think there's any right answer for any golfer. You look at a golfer like Bubba Watson, I mean, his feet are angled at crazy directions, and then you have more conventional people who like it, you know, square to the target, perfect. I'm probably somewhere in between that. But yeah, I want to check in with what's going on with my feet and the start line and curvature of the ball to make sure that the feel, what Adam said, is like you're always checking for the feel versus real. That's super important. But I mean, it sounds like, Mike, for you and your game and getting down to the 3 handicap with maybe being a 10, 11 handicap driver, like that's the final frontier for you. And it sounds like it's mostly a face control issue. You know, if you're having that huge dispersion left to right, I don't know if I think Adam would probably agree with this. It's likely not a curvature thing. It's just you're starting the ball too far right or too far left, and that's where the penalty strokes come from. And unfortunately, like, strategy is a refinement, alignment and making sure all that's a refinement. But if you cannot control the face, you can have all the right targets in the world, and that's the problem. So like that seems to be like the core issue if I'm hearing everything correctly.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Adam, to your question, one of the things that, you know, doing your drills for the past couple of years, I'm mostly in the middle of the face. Like it's not a strike. It's most of the balls that I block dead right are struck in the middle of the face. Like that split second when you make contact, I'm like, oh, that's going to be good. And I'm like, nope, that's in someone's house.
Well, it's good. You only have one thing to work on. And someone.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, like that, it's not, it's almost like, you know, doctors talk about medicine. I've heard is like, you know, when someone shows up to the emergency room, they're trying to eliminate what it couldn't be so they can finally get to the answer. And that essentially is what like golf is like. We're doing, you know, you have to do triage on your own game and saying like, when you start paying attention to these impact fundamentals, which is great that you know that you're striking it center on the face. Well, you know, it can't be gear effect if you're striking it on the center. And it sounds like if it's starting so far right or so far left, like it's probably not a swing path thing because it's not curving that way. It's just starting and ending up there. So yeah, it sounds like you need to have a bit more awareness of where that face is, which I wish I had an answer for everyone. But a lot of it is like, I think, self-exploration. For me, it was like I got a lot of control of the driver face through a lot of half swings sometimes where I would just almost be hitting like these punch. I think punch shots are great, whether it's irons or driver.
I do love punch shots.
Good way to get face awareness. And we've talked about setting up reference points is like, can you start this one right of your target? Can you start this one down the line and left? And for me, it brings, I'm showing you guys on video here, but we're going to talk about it. My cue is what my trail forearm is doing, is how it's rotating. And I could feel that in my swing. And sometimes if I'm noticing blocks, that's my adjustment cue for me. It might be totally different for someone else, but that's how I've kind of arrived at better face control with my driver, is that we're always paying attention to the target and where it's showing up in relation to it, and then trying to establish some type of internal reference point, and that could be different for everyone, but you know, you almost have to start peeling back the layers there and focusing on that, I think.
Hey, John, I'm curious, how long do you think it took you to turn it from a weakness into a strength where you were comfortable to actually go on the course and be aggressive? And then the other thing I'm curious about is, did you feel like you had to get control of the aim before you could really start to unleash distance, or did you do them both at the same time? Like, how did that happen?
Let me just do some quick back of the napkin math here. I started at 30, yeah, maybe 20 years.
There you go, Mike.
I mean, yeah, I did not. I would say the first 20 years of my golf life, I had very poor face control.
Yeah.
Hey, you just gave us a long runway of the rest of the podcast.
Well,
did you hear that, sponsors? There's going to be a lot of shows out there.
to get into your point is like, I don't know if there's a right answer for everyone, like going at the full speed. I think for me, I had to throttle back before I could go hard. So I would say I got better at face control 3-4 years ago with the driver. And since then, where I feel more comfortable, I think I've developed awareness of where the face is during my swing. And then I can see on the course what's going on. I'm hitting it open today. Okay, this is my feel to adjust that on the course or in practice. That took probably a couple of years. And then from there, when I felt like I had that skill more honed in, now I'm working on adding distance through swing speed. And I don't feel like that's messing with my mechanics. Now, can someone work on swing speed and face control at the same time? Yeah, I think so. I think that's possible. I'm not sure there's a right answer for anyone, but I view, you know, we talked about this on the Scratch Golf episode. Of course, strike, you know, Adam and I talk about strike all the time, but for me, it was, you know, how did I get down to scratch? It was mostly a face control issue. And I think that's a lot of the reasons why a lot of golfers are losing strokes is because of penalty shots off the tee, or they're putting themselves in recovery situations. And I usually don't see that as a curvature issue. I see that as a face control issue. Is they're just starting it too far away from their target, and they need to narrow that dispersion window. And it's hard to do, but at least being aware of it and saying, like, that's my issue. And like, you have a SkyTrack, right, Mike?
I do. Mevo Plus now.
Mevo. Okay. So you have the Mevo Plus. You could start looking at that. I mean, you could see your swings. I think they just introduced recently the swing path and the face angle on that. They have that pro package now.
Do you have all that?
Yep. I don't have the pro package yet, but we'll have to do that.
So,
yeah.
I was going to say, when you are having a bad day on the course with the driver, is it a pattern? Like, is it everything is left, or is it just all over the place, two-way? Because they're different issues.
There's days when it's one... If it's a one-way miss, I can normally fix
okay,
it.
Okay, good, yeah.
But the bad, bad days, like, that's what Eli's seen, is like, it's a big block or it's a pull hook.
So when that happens, the two-way miss, is that down to you overcorrecting? So you jumping in and just doing too much of it, or is it just happening?
We are going to take a quick break right there, and we will be right back. When you're hiring for your small business, like I have to, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to find the right professionals for your team faster and free. And you can always support us by checking them out at linkedin.com/sweetspot. LinkedIn is not just another job board. It is a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire. I know a ton of people who are using it for multiple reasons, and LinkedIn has absolutely exploded over the last few years. There's wonderful content on business ideas, but more importantly, it gives you access to professionals that you can't find anywhere else. Anyone who runs a small business knows that hiring is easy when you can get that quality candidate. So easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate from LinkedIn Jobs within 24 hours. LinkedIn knows that people like me and other small businesses like Adam or maybe you are wearing so many hats and you might not have the time or resources to hire. It's not like all of us can have our own HR department. That's why there are over 2.5 million small businesses using LinkedIn for hiring. If you want to give it a shot and post your job for free, go to linkedin.com/sweetspot. That's linkedin.com/sweetspot to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
I don't know. You know, in those rounds, it's more of a, I start crying.
Is it a fetal position on the tee box?
I don't know that I do a great job of analyzing what's going on. When you hit four drives and they all go different places, then like I get confused.
Yeah,
everyone does. I mean, yeah, that is the hardest. I show up to the course someday with that too. It's very difficult to deal with seeing the ball go very far in two different directions.
Yeah,
everyone deals with that.
But I think
at some
you
point.
Might be right, Adam. I mean, it might be, you know, it's an overcorrection. But I also think, you know, before, like to what you were saying, John, about eliminating things it's not. Like, I think this is the first year where I can say, based on everything I've done up until now, I know it's face control. And I don't think I knew that until, like, I didn't go into the last year saying I have to work on face control. It was, my drivers suck. How do I hit driver? But anything I would have grabbed. And I do think it is a face control thing now.
It's going to be one of the two, right?
That's strike, I think. Or... Yeah, I think that's somewhat encouraging, to be honest. I don't want you to be discouraged by that. As you're honing in on the last, and that might be the most difficult bridge to cross skill wise. But you know, if you can focus on that more in your practice sessions and be aware of that, and hopefully start feeling like. If you have no face control awareness and you have those days where it's like going left and right, you know, you're a blind man just, you know, searching for anything. Whereas as you start to develop those internal reference points, and they are different for everyone, that's when, like, quote unquote, the magic can start happening, where you can maybe, and it's not, you know, the difference between you hitting that ball out of bounds to the right or putting it in the right rough is just a little bit of rotation of that club face at impact, open or closed. It's not much. So you're just trying to eliminate those extremes. So yeah, I think, and you being able to measure that on a launch monitor will be super important. You know, we want to do this episode on driver. Me and Adam keep debating on what it is. Is it a technique? Is it a practice thing? We've been texting back and forth. But like, Yeah, I think not everyone has access to a launch monitor that can diagnose those things, but it was very important for me to start seeing, measuring, and knowing what my issues were, and then being able to make small adjustments and then measuring how that changed. Like, you can go on your launch monitor and say, okay, that one was X amount of degrees to the right. Can I make it 2 degrees? Can I make it 1 degree? And start seeing what that feels like. That's a big deal to do stuff like that and measure it, rather than just like haphazardly hitting drivers into a net and not getting the proper feedback, or at the range where you're like, oh, that one looked, you know, like Eli was saying before, that one looked fine. Maybe it wasn't fine. Maybe you weren't aligned at your target. Maybe it was, you know, on the course that would have been out of bounds. So yeah, these are, yeah, that to me is like, you know, it sounds like the rest of your game, you know, your intermediate wedge shots, maybe you can clean up, but yeah, that's, it sounds like the old driver is the scratch guru for you. Should we shift our attention to Eli now?
Let's talk about what's wrong with Eli.
I was watching you hit some really big drives on the opening holes of the finale match, and it didn't seem like you took advantage of them,
didn't I? It was all over. Yeah. I think the
So what is your strokes gained say? Have you been using Golf Metrics?
Yeah, I have. I'm basically a plus handicap driver.
That's what I figured. You got a prodigious length. What's your average drive?
I don't know, Mike. I'm probably 300.
300, 310. Yeah. I mean,
300 to 310, probably.
Wow.
So I have a lot of distance, and I have the opposite issue with Mike. Like, I actually, the driver control wise is also, it's not really a problem for me. I hit a lot of fairways.
He's really, really good and really strong. Like,
I'm way better.
Everybody wants like to be Eli.
I'm way better than Mike.
He's got the keys to the Ferrari, it sounds like.
I'm way better than Mike in a lot of areas. but driving isn't the problem. The problem is I get to approach shots. And, you know, we dove into this a decent bit last year, but I have an upward attack angle with an iron. Literally.
I've like done that before.
Plus half a degree, like. Plus 1.5 degrees.
Yeah.
Like, it's crazy. And
what are your path numbers? Are you very into out?
Well, we were just looking at this. Mike was actually here in Kentucky.
He is very into out. Yep.
A week ago, and I'm like 5 degrees.
That influences
out,
it.
Yeah, you're in John Sherman territory, buddy.
Oh yeah? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Give me some wisdom.
You're not even fully there.
Oh, no. Yeah. I had a couple of 10s and 11s. Don't worry.
Okay, good. Yeah. No, that's John Sherman territory.
Yeah. So what did, I mean, talk me through the process.
Well, Adam, do you want to tackle that one first?
The path, or I should say the swing direction, influences it. So all else being equal, the more to the right you swing, the more on the upswing it will be when you hit it. Because it changes the low point position. If you think about that big hula hoop, if you had a hula hoop and you just turned it all to the right, or you can even do this with a dinner plate on your table, just grab the center of the plate so it doesn't move and then turn the dinner plate to the right, and you'll see the bottom of the plate starts touching the ground a little bit farther back. So the more you turn it to the right, the more that low point goes back, which means you'll be hitting it more on the upswing. So yeah, especially with irons, if you're in to out and on the upswing, probably the first thing I try and do is maybe neutralize that path a little bit, feeling as if you're swinging a little bit more left. The danger with that is you're now influencing direction. You know, if you've played a solid draw all your life and that's how you've seen everything, then you don't want to change that too much, and a swing direction change might do that. So the other option would be to shift the low point forwards just laterally through maybe more weight shift or ball a little bit farther back or later release, something like that. But getting that ground contact farther forwards, using a divot board will do that pretty well. Or a good drill is the towel behind the golf ball. You know, give yourself maybe, you know, a palm width or something away. But that will encourage you to move that low point forwards. Otherwise, you'll beat the towel up.
Well, some of the stuff, Adam, off of your site, when I look back over times when I was playing, over the last couple of years when I was playing.
Eli, be careful here. Don't go behind the paywall.
well,
Don't go behind the paywall.
Some of the drills you had, they're great, but they were all about low point and the divot point. And when I've played my best iron play, that was kind of the main thought, was, you know, to be consciously aware of, you know, striking ball first and all that. But I just had, I don't know what it was about last year. I had a horrible time with it. And, you know, we worked on some swing left, you know, drills, but it's absolutely my focus area this year. Is
how many strokes, are you losing on approach to a scratch golfer? Or what was your handicap for approach shots?
I'd have to look. I'm losing two or three around easily.
Okay. What about the rest of your game? So you're slightly gaining off the tee.
Good on the tee. Good on long irons. My long irons are plus handicapped. I'm anemic with a putter in my hand. It's awful. I have a, you know, like the down the line slow-mo swing videos where they get that nice release and the club comes up. That's what my putter release looks like. It just kind of goes up and it finishes real high. Like I've always been a horrible putter, Mike. Yeah. Like I have a chicken wing. I don't know what, I'm a terrible putter. And the Golf Metrics app, it was really interesting. I played my best golf of the season actually when we did our summer, you know, our summer tour. And I had just come off of 5 weeks of really, really focused practice with the Golf Metrics app. And what the data told me was that I was pretty terrible everywhere, but I was really, really bad from outside of 20 feet. And so I went
speed
control everywhere. I went and put, you know, I marked out 20 feet all over the practice green at my club. You know, I put the little, you know, the little tees are in a circle around the hole. So I knew, you know, kind of what was the range I needed to be in. And I did that probably 5 days a week. And I had a run of really good speed control for a couple weeks, but it's just not, that's not one of those, you know, we all have parts of our game we can kind of find quickly. That's just not one for me. If I don't stay on top of it, it goes and I have a really hard time getting it. But that's putting is a struggle, and I'm not great. I'm not great around, you know, that's where Mike, you know, Mike is really good with a putter in his hand, and he's really, really good around the greens plus handicap range. And that's always been the thing for years. You know, I would hit the ball by him and he would be in a terrible position on his second shot. And then he would just miracle his way around the green with a great shot and a great putt. And I could never beat him.
Well, that's why it's interesting to hear, you know, you guys are at a similar playing level, but this is a great exercise and why tracking your stats and using strokes gained is a good starting point, because, you know, for Mike to be somewhere between a 3 and a 5 handicap with being, let's just call it what it is, a pretty bad driver of the golf ball.
So call it worse.
He has to outperform with his wedges and putter. And how's your iron game, Mike? Is it decent?
It's decent. It's about a 5.
Okay. So that's in line with what you are. So you're outperforming inside of 100 yards and you're underperforming with the driver. And Eli sounds like he's quite the opposite.
Polar opposite.
Now, which position would I want to be in? This will be the real interesting, you know, from here on out over the next few years, which one of you gets to scratch, is that perhaps Eli's hill is not as hard to climb with the putter. I don't know. Or maybe that iron player cleaning up, or if Mike gets control of that face with a driver, watch out. But it's interesting to go through the relative strengths and weaknesses of your game and then try and narrow down what the issues are. And that's how you have the targeted focus practice and also paying attention to the feedback on the course. Yeah, you know, this is the stuff we try and talk about all the time on the show, and this is a great real-world example of it. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back. And we're back. So Eli, let's fix you a little bit more here.
Please do it. Let's go.
Okay. So with the irons, is it, let's try and work backwards with our impact laws, as we like to do. When you're missing greens, is it directional left right? Do you feel like it's a ground contact issue where you're missing it short of the green? Like with those, it sounds like you're a good long iron player, but like, let's say you blast your 320 yard drive and you've got your 90 yard wedge shot or your 130 yard pitching wedge, whatever they are, and you're starting to feel a little uncomfortable and something bad happens. Like, what do those results look like on the course usually? Is there a pattern there?
Yeah, but the pattern, it's really interesting the way the pattern changed. I think, Mike, you can attest to this, but for the last probably year and a half, which is why I said I think my issue, I'm good when it comes to face control, because I got to the point the last year and a half where I could hit 12, 13 greens in a round.
That's scratch. And that is, you know, greens in regulation is a, you know, we like that statistic, and that's a good benchmark for scratch golf for
right,
sure.
Right. And some of that,
then you got to look into proximity more.
Right. Some of that was just course management. And honestly, listening to you guys, Adam kind of hit on this when we first met him. And then John, when we first spoke with you, you hammered this, but it was like, you all are idiots. Why are you aiming at pins? Which was a novel idea to us. It was like, wait, the pin's on the far right. There's 3 feet of space between that and the edge of the green. You don't aim at the pin.
But it has a flag on it.
It has a flag on it. I'd probably, we'll draw that ball in. It'll be, I can land it right there in that 3 foot gap and just make it sit. So I think some of that was just cleaning up some strategy and aiming. But when it went away from me the last few weeks of the season, I think most of my misses were pulls. You know, most of my misses were misses left.
And short.
It wasn't so much, and yeah, a little short, but I think most of my misses were left.
Now, so you don't hit many fat or thin shots then with irons?
Well, I think I hit a lot. I think I do hit a lot technically fat, because I'm not hitting, I'm coming up with my iron, so I'm hitting behind the ball.
He's but brushing it's not, the it's, ground. It's a, yeah. It's actually phenomenal to watch him hit set, like he, I watched him hit like 15 seven irons, and there was like the ground looked like you took a one guard to the grass. Like you were like, he gave it a fade like a barber. Nice. But there was no actual divot, because he was hitting behind the ball and just coming up on it a little bit.
Well, this is it. You don't necessarily have to get your low point in front. Now, if someone's biggest issues were I'm blading it long and I'm fatting every other shot and I'm losing lots of shots for that, then that would be a case of saying, right, let's get this low point farther forwards, because it's going to make an easier task for you. But if you've got exceptional height control or depth control, you know, you can just brush the grass perfectly every time, like John is similar to this as well, then you might not want to go into changing the low point. I'll be honest, I assumed when you said you were hitting up on it that you're hitting lots of fats and thins. So it's for you to look at your stats and say, well, if I'm missing more left and right, I gotta just control the face direction better or pick safer aim points. But if it starts to become fat and thin, that's when you'll start to go into low point control. But yeah, we might not want to touch that necessarily. Now, when you hit it short,
that's a strange combination, though, of him pulling it short. You know, what do you think about that?
Well, yeah, I was going to ask, is that
a strike issue?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you'd have to determine, right?
It's maybe a little. It's a little. How are your? Because if you're hitting it short and left, my mind's going to, obviously the face is closed down, so it's a face control issue. But typically, especially for someone who is into out and you're hooding it a bit, you're probably going to hit it a little bit further. So how's your strike with your irons? Are you taking a look at that?
Well, I know there's, and this is a constant theme, I'm definitely heel biased.
Okay, me too, not surprisingly.
Yeah, so, and that's very, very consistent, which is why a lot of the work lately that I've been doing has been more about moving that point on the face, you know, with some of the drills and things. But I'm heel biased. I tend, like Mike said, I don't really hit a lot of fat shots. I just brush. But it's a problem, you know, when I'm barely off the fairway and I'm in any kind of, you know, second cut or first cut or whatever, it's hard to get down into the ball. I struggle with those. Actually, there was a shot in the final major, I think it was on the 15th hole, but I had thumped a drive, but it was sitting down just in a little bit of that Carolina, kind of that crabgrass, and it should have been a pretty easy shot to get out, and I could not go down and get it. You know, so I have a hard time with that.
That's the biggest disadvantage of that low point being behind and having a shallow angle of attack, is if it's pristine conditions, if you're sitting up on a nice little bit of turf and you've got good height control, you'll be able to, let's say, get away with it. But the moment you stick someone on a hard pan lie or in deep rough, you know, you're lost there, because even a small drop in height is going to result in a really bad shot. So certainly you know, it's something you just have to determine how many shots are you losing from these strike issues or inability to get out of certain lies. And then you you build your practice around that. But with the short and left, yeah, I mean, as John said, if you hood the face down, usually the ball goes a little longer, because all else being equal, when that face closes, it reduces spin loft. So we tend to hit long and left. So I'd just be interested, when you do hit those short shots, again, going deeper into the analysis and saying, well, how was my ground contact? Was it fat or even a little bit thin? Did it go short because of that? Was it face strike? Was it a little bit more out of the heel or toe than usual? Or did I strike it okay? And it was just a club selection. I just picked the wrong club selection. I was trying to attack that front pin. Usually those are the things. The other things might be you just misjudged the wind. Again, you think you picked the right club, but you didn't think the wind was going to hurt it that much. Maybe a miscalculation, maybe after you've hit it. I've done this before. I hit it and I go, that's gone short. Oh, I didn't take into account that it's uphill. I mean, even at my level, I'll occasionally do that. So it's just going into those things and you'll start to see patterns, because, again, it's pointless going off and working on your face strike if it's club selection that's the issue. Instead, it's just worth seeing the pattern on a piece of paper, perhaps, and saying, wow, I made 5 club selection issues here. So that just starts to change your decisions before you make the shot then.
One thing that's interesting to me, you know, when you've had years and years of not being a great iron player, I think you start to compensate for that in different ways when you have an iron in your hand, because you're not used to getting a real good quality strike. And so it's always interesting to me, if I have a shot and I just hood the face a little bit, just a little bit, my strike quality immediately is, I mean, it's pure as can be. And I don't know what that is. Like, every time I'm in a position where I have to play a long, you know, I have to take a full swing and maybe try to make the ball turn over a little bit, and I hood the face, and every one of those when I'm more closed, hooded the face, like the quality of the strike gets so much better. And I've always wondered, why is it doing that? You know, because I have no idea. I have no idea why I do that. Maybe there's a good explanation, and maybe that tells you a little bit about where I'm missing and where I'm ultimately failing.
Well, it'll change something at impact. I mean, it could be something random, like it moves the strike more towards the center. That doesn't, I mean, there's a little bit of logic behind that, but usually it just feels more compressed. I'm sure you're probably talking about that, which is just a reduction in spin loft, really. So
yeah, I mean, you and me have very similar patterns with our irons. And again, what am I, not that my answer will be the same as yours, but, you know, as someone who struggles sometimes with an excessive into out path and being too shallow, you know, one of my big cues to counteract that is that I've always had to feel like I'm flashing that. I like that face open. You know, I'll almost flash my iron face open at impact as a cue, because, you know, if I'm going to make a mistake on the course, it's probably going to be a combination of closing the face and my path getting too extreme, which results in that pull hook. I can live with that high block where I'm opening the face more. My matchup is like, I got a lot of shaft lean. That helped me a lot. I mean, keeping that face open. Would that work for you? I don't know. And part of it also getting too shallow is sometimes I can be a little bit of a swayer with my weight. So one of my cues is that, especially on like short and mid irons, is that I almost have to remind myself to keep my weight on my lead side. So on my left foot. Now, is all my pressure actually there? No way. Like, I've been measured on a pressure mat and I actually have pretty good weight distribution moving back and forth. But I almost feel like I have to keep that weight there so I can coil more rather than swaying. And when I sway, then I'm going to get super shallow and probably way too into out. So those are just kind of some internal feels that I came across over the years to work with my matchup, which is similar to yours. And it, you know, similar to what we're suggesting to Mike with this face control with the drivers, if you can start to narrow down what the issues are, if you're telling me it's short and left, you know, maybe we need to get that face a little bit more open and improve strike more.
Your swaying comment is really interesting to me, Mike. And I was just telling Mike this a week ago, but you know, when we were with Irish Mike and we went through the fitness testing and all that, I score well on explosiveness. I score horribly on flexibility.
Yeah.
And specifically in my shoulders.
Is it your rotational ability?
A little bit, but it's my shoulder. The thing that jumped out at me was shoulder flexibility. It was really, really poor. And
worst shoulders that Irish Mike has ever seen. Yeah. Irish Mike actually asked Eli if he'd ever thrown a ball in his life.
He did. He goes, well, clearly I can see that you've never played baseball. I was like, I played till I was 12. What? I don't understand what's going on right now. And then he called me the Tin Man for the rest of the day. But no, I have horrible shoulder flexibility. And I told Mike, you know, it's really interesting. If I was looking at some swings of mine from this past season, and if you just drew the lines vertically down each side of my hips.
You're like 5 feet outside.
I'm not. I actually really? Turn. Turn is inside of it. But what's really interesting to me is my head moves away. And I told Mike, I said, I'm really curious if the fact that I don't have a lot of neck and shoulder flexibility, if that turn away with my head, even though my body stays, if that's causing me to get, we're just talking about fractions off here with a low point. You know, it's like, is that causing me to just do some things? Is that causing my low point to be influenced? But I get a little sway with my head, even though my lower body stays coiled in, you know, the way it's supposed to be.
I'd say looking for a reason why, I would almost go the other way and just say, from a more positive point of view, what could I do to get that low point farther forwards? Instead of, because it's a case of all else being equal, if I do X, Y, and Z, I will get the low point more forward. So if you were to keep your weight more on your left-hand side, that would move the low point forwards. If you're to move the ball back in your stance, that would move the low point forwards relative to the ball. If you're to do a later release, which is much more complicated to learn, but if you're to do a later release, that will move the low point forwards. Or if you're to swing more left, that will move the low point forwards. Those are basically your only options. That is geometry.
Yeah, you're just describing like everything I've done to try and deal with this matchup. Yeah, eventually, you know, to figure it out, like these are, you know, for me, it's through experimentation and stuff like that. I'm just hitting balls and looking and looking and looking. It's like, yeah, more shaft lean, more weight on the lead side. Trying to swing left is one of my big cues with my irons when I'm struggling. We always talk about doing the opposite of your fault. If I'm struggling with the closed hook, I'm rehearsing a fade swing where I'm like keeping the face open and trying to swing left. And I'm absolutely not going to do that on my swing, but I'm trying to shift that reference point away from extreme to functional. It's again, the answer isn't, I mean, Adam is listing the correct answers to fix the matchup issue. It's just, now what can you translate that to internally through practice and being on the course to making that change? Is just shifting that low point a little bit, improving that face strike a little bit.
There's a science and there's an art to this. The science is very clear. If you want to move the low point forwards, those are your options. Weight shift, later release, swing more left, pretty much it, or ball position. There's not much else that you could do. The art part of this is, well, which one is right for you? Because, I mean, getting you to swing more left, well, yeah, that's going to move the low point forwards. It's going to make your path more neutral. But how's that going to affect your shot shape and your direction, which is a strength for you? You know, that's the part where there's no crystal ball. You know, as an instructor, I can certainly make suggestions based on what I want. Then you start to go into, well, do you want to see less of a draw? Do you want to see more of a straighter shape? Okay, then swing direction is a better option. But it's a case now of kind of exploring and seeing which one feels right to you, which one works better for you, which one produces the better outcomes. And even that will change a little over time. I mean, the first time you make a swing direction change, you could be horrible with it. But then a couple of months down the line, you found this new level that you never had before. And this, like I said, this is the art part of it. The science part is the easiest part in golf instruction, really.
And the interesting thing, like looking at your overall game, would be that I would say, yeah, getting like based on what you told me, like it sounds like putting is the issue still, but you're a great driver of the golf ball. If you're telling me you're hitting it over 300 yards, like you've got the keys to the Ferrari, right? So now you've got to capitalize on that length and accuracy by not vomiting all over yourself with these iron shots.
Yes.
And it's probably honestly, like it's, you know, I am still very encouraged for both of you on your quest here, because those are probably the final pieces of the puzzle for you. Because let's say, Eli, you get a little bit more control of the irons and your proximity to the hole is a little bit better. Well, then maybe like you're maybe hitting a lot of greens, but you're probably leaving yourselves a lot of 40, 50 foot putts, correct?
Right, right.
So let's say you reduce your proximity by 10 feet on average, which is something that, you know, 4 handicap or 5 handicap to a scratch golfer could do, something like that. Well, then putting gets a little bit easier because now your speed control is not under assault as much. So I wouldn't call the iron play a low-hanging fruit, but I think that's probably the best bang for your buck of putting your focus there. I would certainly say, you know, continue to do the speed control with your putting if that's really causing you all those three putts. But you'd almost be getting a double whammy with the iron play,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, one Agreed. Of the things I want to say, something Adam said, you know, when I said, I jumped in and said you were missing short. But when I think about the specific shots I'm thinking about are all off of hard pan Carolina Bermuda. Like they were at Pinehurst and they were at the final major, which is not the surface you normally play. So
that's right.
Adam, just to like the way you were talking about that, I wonder if he can normally get away with it off of his ryegrass or whatever, bluegrass, whatever they play in Kentucky. But a lot of the courses we play with Bermuda, where it's a tighter lie, that, cause I'm thinking about those wedge shots on 1, 4, 11.
Oh yeah. You're definitely not going to get away. Yeah. Know, when you get tougher lies like that, it definitely starts to reveal low point control issues more.
Yeah.
So, but my question would be, and not to help Eli too much here, but like what we were talking about the other day, Eli, was what you wouldn't want to do is make a big swing change and stop hitting up on it like you are on your driver, because yeah, that's what's making right. you such a,
that's a good a point.
Yeah, that's like, yeah.
So when Adam, when you said ball position, I'm like, does he just move his ball position?
Could be as simple
with
as
his,
that.
And
it's possible. Yeah. I think it could be that simple. You don't know until you try. I would say to you is whether you start using maybe more of one of those shot tracking companies, whether it's like Arcos or ShotScope, start looking back, you know, when you can see the shot distribution from certain distances and you know you are playing a consistent style of course or turf, as Mike is alluding to, that would help a lot more versus like these kind of like, well, I think it might be, but I'm not sure if it's, you know, you want to see this stuff more. And as Adam always talks about, is like also track during your practice as well. Is like, are you seeing that pattern when you're practicing as well? So,
well, it's so funny though, even, and this is the stupidity of Mike and I. I'm throwing you back in this moment.
Yeah, we're talking about you.
Nah, this is both of us. But like, even in my head, like hearing all this stuff, I'm like, yes, yes, yes. And then there's that little voice that goes, or it could be something technical that you could just completely rework, and then you've got it. Like it's such a good reminder hearing these things, you know, like the matchups, and you know, you got to find what works for you. What works, like John, what, even though we've got the same issues, what works for you might not work for me.
Exactly. Like I find that the ball position thing is tough for me because I de-loft so much. So I'm like working against, as my loft on my irons decrease, I have no choice but to move the ball forward in my stance.
Yeah.
I can't, you know, for me to hit an 8 iron in the middle of my stance,
That's harder for me. I almost have to put that ball forward. So I'm like working on both sides of the extreme. And like maybe I need to work a little bit more on my weight shift to keep that low point where it needs to be versus, you could tell me, oh, move it to the middle of your stance. Well, that's like, well, that creates another issue for me because now the swing path is going to be more into out because it's more back in my stance.
Right.
So unfortunately, this is the can of worms with all these matchups. But you're getting closer and closer to the core issue rather than just saying like, well, I'm going to experiment with putting my swing plane up here today and tomorrow I'm going to be super flat. Like, you know, that's not what Adam and I believe in necessarily. Right. It's not saying those things couldn't work. If you, let's say you were working with Adam directly and he said, listen, I think this is a technical issue. I'm not against, you know, you working on these positions, or he could tell you, you know, try and strike that piece of grass 3 inches in front of the ball. Like, it's tough to say which one will work better. You know where I'm coming from is like, I haven't looked at video of my swing in over a decade. Like, I don't I don't go that route. I just try and problem solve based on the tendencies in my ball flight. And those things that Adam described, I didn't know technically those are the solutions, but I just kind of arrived at those over time through so much experimentation and paying attention.
Yeah, and that's still a hard thing. I think it's just that whole vanity issue. It's very hard. I mean, I was telling Mike, even, you know, we played our final major. It was the first time we've played in front of people, you know, and it was like, I'm hitting my driver well, but I wonder what they think about my swing. Like, and there's just still so many of those battles, you know, where you go, gosh, just, if you know you do something well, just be okay with how it looks and just go on with it and don't worry about it.
I've had people say to me when they saw me play in person for the first time saying, well, you're kind of furic. You're kind of a little furicky. I'm like, thank you. That's great. Appreciate that. I mean, you almost have to, it's hard not to think that way because, you know, you guys read all the articles and all the listening to some of your first episodes, you fell victim to the same stuff I did growing up about golf is like, we are always worried about the aesthetics of our swing and what they look like. And I will say, you know, Mike, you do have a pretty looking golf swing. Like I could tell you that wow, club twirl you had, that, I remember that one shot you hit where you like knocked it stiff in the club twirl. I mean, that was like tour level looking stuff. Like my swing, I could tell you right now, my swing will never look prettier than yours will ever. And I'm okay with that. That's okay.
I'm not okay with it. You might be okay. I'm the one that does a show with him. I'm not okay.
Yeah. But what matters is are the results, right? If you guys are competing against one another, like if your swing looks like crap, who cares, right? You want to hone in on those patterns and essentially tighten that shot dispersion. That's the name of the game here. But yeah, it's hard to let go of. I mean, I've had to, unfortunately. I gave up on that a long time ago.
Yeah, even for me, it's there as well. I've done videos that I've posted on Instagram or something where I hit 10 shots in a row on the simulator, all to within tour proximity. So it's like half tour proximity, basically. So the results are good, and then someone will comment, oh, the swing looks ugly, you're laid off at the top, or something like that. And I'm like, I see. So I find myself doing videos myself and trying to get myself into positions just to please those people rather than just focusing on the results. Not for myself, because I don't care how it looks, I care how it performs, but I know that there are so many people who just can't separate those things. They see aesthetics as the main goal. And even then, even if you get your swing looking great, it'll still be someone who says there's something wrong with it. There's always going to be someone there. But there are ways of tying in better, improved quality with aesthetics. I mean, my process, and this is true for every listener here, even whether you're a beginner, pro, you look at the outcomes. That's what we're getting at here. So you look at the outcomes, you try and determine where you're losing your strokes. So if you're using strokes gained apps, perfect. And then you decide from there, well, what is the thing at impact that's causing it? So if it's short or long issues, then it's going to be a ground contact or face contact, usually. If it's left or right, it's going to be a face direction issue in most cases. So you determine the impact thing. In some cases, it might not be a problem with impact. It might be a psychological thing. Like we said, you might strike it perfectly. You've just picked the wrong club. So once you've determined the outcomes that are costing you shots, you've determined what's happening at impact that's causing that outcome error, then you can go into, well, what can I change then to improve that? So in Eli's case, it's in a certain example, it's I'm hitting it short with certain clubs. Why? Because from a certain lie, I can't get ball first contact because the angle attack is too shallow. So then the change is going to be, well, I need to get that low point farther forwards. And then we can say, well, what could I do to get that low point farther forwards? Which goes into, well, we have all these different options. And now you could select an option that goes in with vanity. If you were swaying your head offline a lot, not that you said you were, but if you were swaying your head off, that is an option that would both improve it from a vanity perspective and would get the low point farther forward. So it's not that these things have to be divorced from each other. It's just, like I said, this is the process that I go through in my head with every single play, and it's very logical. It's very definite as well. And so there's always an answer. Like I said, the art part to it is which change is better. You know, for some people, it might be a simple feel change. For example, if I'm missing left, you know what my change is? I just open the face at address a little bit and then regrip it. It's really, really simple if it's a pattern. So it doesn't have to be a complicated fix. Yeah, so I've said my piece.
All right, so we got a little bit more time with these guys, so we'll fire through. I knew what I was getting into, and I posted my usual request for questions on Twitter. I'm like, I know 70% of these responses are going to be about sharks and Carl Weathers and the 7,000. What's the mineral water you drink, Mike? The
Topo Chico.
We don't have time to get into all that because there's just way too many inside jokes.
By the time this podcast airs, we'll probably be sponsored. They'll probably be our headlining sponsor.
I hope this
will be enough for a quarry or a board of directors meeting with Topo Chico.
All right. So let me fire off some more sweet spot related questions. What's the best bang for your buck in terms of investments? You know, obviously there's a lot of golf products you can purchase, and I don't, you know, if you guys are uncomfortable giving some free ads away or whatever, but has there been anything that stuck out in your quest as you've come from 11 handicaps down to low mid single digits? Anything that you felt legitimately helped you that you invested in?
This is going to sound like I'm just pandering to Adam here, but I mean, I bought the Strike Plan, and I bought bought his book before we talked to him. Those were huge. And the fundamental understanding that I didn't have before, like I still go back, Adam, and listen. I listened to it on the way back from Kentucky, the episode you did with us, because I need to remind myself of those things constantly, of about what's important and what's not important. And you know, like Eli said, we still get stuck on vanity, even though we know that's not important. But that's the first time that I'd really heard that stuff. So I'd say that would make that's made a huge difference. But then also, I think I would say having someone that you trust that you can go see in person is important too. At least that's been important for me, and I think it's been important for Eli.
Yeah, I would definitely echo that. I think the only other thing I'd add, I'm really interested this year. I think Mike mentioned earlier we've got the Mevo Plus. We've never had a launch monitor to be able to kind of analyze, other than going into a lesson and, you know, seeing what our local guy, you know, and the data. So I'm really curious to see. Mike and I went to Florida probably 2 years ago, and we were down at some nice golf academy, you know, near the resort we were staying at. And we went down and had a lesson with the guy, and he said, you know, it was really interesting. Cause again, my stupid brain and how this all works, I thought he would come in and do all kinds of technical stuff. And he basically put a swing, you know, a launch monitor in front of us and said, okay, you're swinging in and out. You think you want to try to swing, you know, you want to try to change that a little bit more. Let's see if we can get that number down. And that was just kind of the whole thing. And, you know, it was just interesting watching this, our swings change more off of feel than off of technical changes. So I think I'm really interested to see how that aids in our practice this year.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about launch monitors a lot. I think they, if you know what you're looking for, and I think you guys are closer than ever to know what you're looking for, they can be super helpful, with especially if you're getting you know, face angle and club path, those metrics, which it sounds like Mevo Plus is just getting right now, or now when this episode is aired, it'll be out for a couple months. Then you could start doing experiments and those internal reference points and verifying what's going on. So, and then, you know, to echo your point, Mike, is like learning what you did from Adam's book and getting back to impact fundamentals and understanding that stuff. That's important. Now, let's say you didn't know any of that stuff and you did get a launch monitor, I'd say, hey, stay away from this because you don't know what you're looking for. But you guys have learned enough over the last 4 or 5 years through your journey where, yeah, you could play around with that. And you're not going to be like you said, Mike, you're not going to be worrying about technical stuff in your swing. You're saying, like, what could I do to move that number one way or another? Can I try swinging a little bit more left and see if that makes my path less into out? Can I move my ball position and see how that changes things too? So that to me would probably be helpful for the two of you, is getting that verification from a launch monitor at this point.
Yep, agreed.
Let's see what other questions we've got. Here's a fun one for you, because I was thinking about this a lot. Do you think Kingpin is the best Farrelly Brothers movie?
Oh, man.
That's not from Twitter. That's from me.
I'll say it has the best character.
It has the best character.
I don't think it's the best movie. I have to go Dumb and Dumber. Dumb and Dumber has to be number one for me, movie-wise.
It's tough because, you know, we're all similar ages, and those movies were dearly important to us. Dumb and Dumber, Kingpin, and Something About Mary.
I've never seen Kingpin. Oh. I've seen the others. Dumb and Dumber, Something About Mary, yeah, but Kingpin? I'm going to have to watch that one.
I think looking back on it, Kingpin to me, like you said, Bigger and McCracken might be top five like character ever.
We did a podcast for our Patreon listeners, and the first one we did a top five, like we said, okay, for this one, we're going to talk about something not golf related. The first thing we thought of was, all right, Eli, you go make a top five list of characters, TV or movie, and I'll do the same thing. And we came back, and I thought, there's no chance he would have Big Earn number one. We both had Big Earn as the best character of all time.
Yeah, so, I think it's like Bill Murray's had some really great performances in his career. I listen, he's had some serious movies that have been great, some comedies. I mean, that's one of his best roles for me.
It's unbelievable.
It's every scene. There's no weakness in it. Yeah, there's not a bad word he says. So, Adam.
Nope.
Right after this call, you need to watch.
I've written it down, yeah.
For me, looking back, like, I think when they first came out, Something About Mary made me laugh the hardest because it was like, I mean, all Farrelly Brothers are slapstick in your face. There was just like more like scenes that when you saw them for the first time, you're like, oh my God, like I'm peeing my pants right now.
Something About Mary, though, do you find yourself quoting it? I see, like, yeah, we hardly ever quote it.
Listen, I refer to Estadio Olimpico all the time still.
we talk about Nepalese coins a lot, Eli.
Yeah.
That's
a good point. I still quote a lot of lines from it, but when I think about being Munsoned out in the middle of nowhere,
I think you're right. I had to think.
It might be the best movie.
It's the smartest one. Like it's really smart.
Yes.
Yeah. And honestly, when I think back, that's the one I've watched the most. I've watched Kingpin more than any of those other movies.
Yeah. Maybe Dumb and Dumber. Yeah. Dumb and Dumber has a lot of repeat value for sure. But the acting it was just a goofier movie, obviously, because this is the way it was. But yeah, looking back on it now, like I am almost gravitating towards Kingpin, which is kind of crazy to say, but that's why I wanted to pose the question.
It's a great question.
It's a tough one.
I'm in with you, Sherman. I got Kingpin number one.
So, Adam, you got to watch that, and then you could make your judgment. That was my question.
I love it.
Okay. Here's another tough question for you guys. Is your goal still to reach scratch, or is it more to develop and enjoy the community that the both of you have created?
I'll take that one. It's absolutely to get to scratch. And, you know, we're going to talk about this later on with our show, but Mike had a call that he did in secret, and he didn't even invite me to, with our sports psychologist, Dr. J. But But Dr. J asked this, he asked this really interesting question, which has really, Mike was playing me the video the other day. It really kind of got in my head, but he said, is the goal to be a scratch golfer or to get to scratch?
Mm.
And I know that, that I think on the surface that may sound like the same question, but if you really think about it, you know, it, I think it really cut through a lot of things with Mike and I, or at least it did with me, where, you know, you start to analyze parts of your game and you're like, well, all right, I'm a five here. That's pretty good. But, you know, I'm a plus here. So, you know, we'll just keep going here. That's good enough. I can clip scratch, you know, if I just clean up a couple things. But then if your goal is to really get to scratch and stay at scratch and be a scratch golfer, it's like, no, I've really got to put work in these areas. And they have to go from things that I can survive with to things that are actually additive on a course. So I, you know, for me, the goal is it's absolutely to get to scratch. I don't think that has any bearing on our community. We just, you know, I think if anything, that'll make the community even better, but that's, I want to get there.
Yeah. I would answer it that the goal is definitely scratch. But to that question, I would say the thing, like if you were to tell me that I would never get to scratch, but we would still have our community, like I would take the community. Like that's how much I love, you know, the camaraderie and the listeners that we have. So I'm trying to say both a little bit, but I think that's
a fair answer.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys have built something real. It's significant. And what do they say about the journey being better than the whatever it is that's saying?
the destination?
Whatever. The destiny. Yeah, that thing.
The Munson.
My mind is Munsoned. All right. Sounds like you guys got to get going. Are we out of time here? Okay. All right. Let's keep going. All right. Here's another one. What is your Wordle strategy? And how can you use it to shoot lower scores? I don't even know what. All I know is that like I've become obsessed with this game too. I know people hate it on Twitter. Anytime you mention it, like I get like real hatred at me. But like I love it too. I'm going through the archives every night. I'm 100 out of like 229. This morning, my son and my wife beat me. I did it in five. I don't know if you've done today's yet, but it seemed like it was obvious, but it wasn't.
Yeah, I got it.
And my wife got it in three, and my 8-year-old son got it in four, and I got it in five, and I went crazy.
I got lucky on the second guess, so I got it in three. But no, I love it. And honestly, I'm not sure if you've seen people that are treating it like a golf hole. They treat Wordle like a par four. and honestly, Eli, I'm not sure if you saw this. It just happened yesterday. One of our listeners made a website, Chasing Scratch Wordle. It's got a logo. It's got a polar bear with a golf club, and we're gonna play Riverbend as Wordle for 18 days starting on Saturday. But no, I love Wordle. I don't know how it will help me at golf.
I don't know. That question makes no sense to me at all.
So I figured I'd just throw Wordle out there.
I just love the fact that someone built something that you can only do once a day. And they didn't take the bait of making it like super monetized. I know the guy just sold it to New York Times.
Yeah, is that a good time to mention that he made a few million dollars off of it? Which I totally like. Yeah. Some people are like throwing shade at this guy, and I'm like, please, no, you would have taken the money too.
But I love the fact that you can only play it once a day. Like that's the biggest complaint is like, well, I want to keep playing it. But I was like, no, that makes it better. It's one time, you do it once a day.
It's a phenomenal game. You guys, Adam and Eli, you guys should try
it. I sent you the link, Eli. I'm shocked that you haven't tried it.
I've got King Ping and Wordle to look at.
Yeah, you've two. You've ruined my life with VR ping pong. Now I'm ruining yours with Wordle.
VR ping pong? Wait a minute.
Yeah, you guys got to.
What?
I saw one of the responses, and they said, I would like a 10-minute conversation on VR ping pong.
So yeah, we mentioned this will be our like fifth episode we talk about VR ping pong. But yeah, whoa. Adam convinced me to buy an Oculus Quest, and the ping pong we'll give 11 ping pong a free ad again. Like it's just so real, like it's like playing real ping pong, and you play against people around the world and you get ranked. Like the other day I got down to 823rd in the world and then I imploded and like was ready to break the thing like 24 hours later. Like you have like a ranking.
I smacked my controller on my head yesterday.
Oh, it's getting out of control. Like I pride myself on being level-headed on the golf course because I had to deal with temper issues for a long time. And now it's like, it's just happening all over again with VR ping pong. Like I'm just going backwards.
Can we have a podcast competition? First of all, I love ping pong.
Oh, you got to get it.
My parents just bought my boys the Oculus for when they come over. I'll just go steal it. And
just take it from them.
Yeah.
I don't let my kids use it. I tell my kids they can go on it for 20 minutes a week. It's mine. It's in my office. It's right next to me.
I'm all in on this.
They're not allowed to use it. Get it.
Done.
Are you holding an actual ping pong racket or are you just holding?
No.
It's
the paddle. You're holding the controller, right? The VR controller.
But when you're in the metaverse, it looks like, I'm telling you, once you get used to it, like you're tapping the ball, like it feels like you don't want to run into the virtual table because you're afraid you're going to hurt yourself.
Hey, Oculus, are you listening? You want to throw a couple dollars our way? There's a chance.
It's unbelievable, and it's also ruining my life.
So who's better, Adam or John?
Oh, John is, yeah.
I had a head start on Adam. Adam was not a ping pong player growing up. I was. He's quickly gaining on me, though. He's getting very good very fast.
It's all spin. It's all impact spin.
Little backhand cutter. Little backhand cutter.
I'll tell you what. There's a lot of wrist angles and face control going on, Adam. Am I right? Like, I often think about how I need to, especially with, it's my right hand. Like, there's a lot of similarities there with golf with how I'm angling the paddle and the spin I'm trying to create.
I've already started analyzing the impact physics and my strokes gained with ping pong. I'm there already.
Chasing the number one world ranking on Oculus. That'll be the next podcast.
This is how we get better. This is how we. How do I improve face control? Oculus ping pong.
So they just released our tournament schedule for my local governing body, the MGA. I'm looking at all the tournaments I want to play this year, and I'm thinking to myself, I am not working as hard as I should be on my golf game right now because of this stupid virtual ping pong. And I need to, like, one day I want to lose my temper and break the thing so I can't use it anymore. I told my wife that last night. She's like, are you trying to break that? I'm like, I hope I do. Because then I won't log in anymore. All right. I think time's up. That's a great place to end the discussion, right?
That's perfect. Perfect.
I think the four of us need to perhaps play golf in person. Perhaps if you guys have another event, maybe Adam and I will show up. We'll see.
That'd be awesome.
Let's do it.
It'd be great to tee it up in real life. So yeah, where can everyone find you guys? You have a website, you got a podcast. Give us your plugs.
Website, chasingscratchgolf.com. Podcast is Chasing Scratch Podcast, or it's Chasing Scratch : a golf podcast.
Just search for it. Yeah.
And then YouTube, we'll have a lot more video this year as well, which, that gets back to what you were saying, Adam. Got to blind ourselves to those comments that make us want to change our vanity, but it's just Chasing Scratch Podcast on YouTube.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, for anyone who hasn't listened to the show, like, just do it. It's so much fun. It's funny. Like, it's a great companion show to what we're doing, and we're super happy that the community keeps growing. So thanks for taking time out of your day and talking to us.
Thanks for having us, guys. This was awesome.
Yeah. Thank you very much, guys.
Yeah.
It's awesome. Yeah. Enjoyed it.
Thanks for having us. Thanks for helping us. We appreciate it, guys.
Okay, we'll wrap it up there. Adam, where can they find you?
AdamYoungGolf.com. And John, where can people find you?
You can find me at practical-golf.com. Thank you to everyone for their support, and we will see you next time with a new show.